listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In a week that saw U.S. President Donald Trump pull the U.S. out of the JCPOA agreement with Iran, there were reports of a secret white paper showing that the U.S. intends to help facilitate regime change in the Islamic Republic. For more on that and the situation in general, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, international analyst and senior lecturer in geopolitics at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow Friday. Well, Mark, for me, the most troubling thing here, of course, we have to wait till to see how it actually turns out. But, you know, we're hearing the more than the grumblings, but this hearing about the circulation of a paper by Bolton's crew, at least in the deep background, calling for regime change in Iran and saying that what's, you know, being pursued right now is a policy to enable regime change. I remember, however, the standing ovation that Trump got at the Republican National Convention, much to my surprise, from the assembled Republicans saying no more regime change. And looks like they're going for it full steam, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a huge amount of difference between the Republican base that elected Trump and the neocons that are now essentially running the regime.
Right.
You know, John Bolton, Pompeo, yeah. and others. So what we're looking at is this all comes on the heels, of course, of Trump unilaterally pulling the U.S. out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called nuclear deal,
right,
that was arranged between the U.S. and Iran and, of course, China and Russia and a number of the major European powers, U.K., France, Germany, and so on. And it was fulfilled. It was fulfilled with a U.N. Security Council resolution,
right,
and with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which has certified that Iran is not did not have an active nuclear weapons program.
That's right.
And has a fairly, by all accounts, when a number of even the DC establishment, the majority even, says is a stringent enough, that the U.S. doesn't need to worry about that.
Right.
So Trump pulling out of this came on the heels of a public theater put on by Benjamin Netanyahu, where he surrounded himself with binders and a white screen background with big letters, Iran lied, and so on. And this was obviously meant specifically for the consumption of Donald Trump, personally. Netanyahu,
right,
obviously well aware that Trump doesn't like to read things. He likes things displayed in video format. So this was kind of a personal videogram from Netanyahu to Trump.
You know, let me say this much. As much as we heard at the Republican National Convention and leading up to it, the declared abandonment of, the failure and abandonment of the project of regime change by coming out of Trump's mouth, and with full, they helped get him the nomination, and I'm sure it helped get him elected as well. We also heard simultaneously that the Iran deal, terrible deal, we're going to redo it, it'll be a much better deal, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, he ran on, against the JCPOA as well. And there was really no analysis done about the relationship between those two those two issues, which were, glaring contradiction.
I think there was always a contradiction there. I think we all knew what we were hoping for is that Trump would turn away from regime change in Syria, and to some extent, by some measures, he has. Yeah, he stopped Obama's program of funding jihadis, the CIA's long-term six-seven-year program of illegally arming, training, and salarying sectarian Islamist and jihadist militants, literally allied and embedded with al-Qaeda. I mean, Trump stopped that or at least significantly reduced it to a fairly large extent, though it seems Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey picked up most of the slack in that regard. But they instead shifted their focus towards the Kurds, which had always been supported by the Pentagon, and they've, rather than giving up on the program of direct regime change by military force or by jihadi proxy in Damascus, they instead shifted to partition of eastern Syria, including the oil-heavy areas, and then attempt to leverage – the attempt will be to attempt to leverage that into a political regime change to accomplish politically and with economic blackmail the threat of a permanently – partitioned and destabilized Syria to get what they want, regime change via another method there.
Right, and this was foreshadowed by Trump. As he was referring to the failure in Iraq, he was one of the primary failure that he saw, or at least that he articulated, or let me use a word that for Trump means articulate, but articulated that, if I went in there, I would have taken the oil. Well, policy that follows with the Kurds, the particular Kurds, the Barzanis, for example, they are actually controlling some of that Iraqi oil. And so as you control them, you now are controlling it. And also, as you're talking about partition, you're talking about implementing exactly the policy that he had advocated should have been done in Iraq, which is get the oil.
Yeah, well, so this is the thing about that, because this close alignment with the Kurds, of course, costs the U.S. in relations with both Turkey and Iraq, both of which have their own rest of Kurdish population, have no desire to see an independent Syrian Kurdistan as an example or continuing a struggle into their own countries. And on top of that, the oil doesn't do him much good. There's no pipelines. There's no way to get it out. It's pretty much just a spoiler. It's denying the oil funds that are needed for reconstruction – to the Syrian government.
Right.
And I think that's more what control of that particular oil is about. They're hoping by economic and political blackmail to achieve what they failed to achieve militarily or right. by jihadi proxy this way instead. Right. But we always knew that Trump and those around him were really hard on Iran, and we hoped that was further off in the distance, that Syria was always in the minds of the U.S. neocons just a stepping stone on the path to Iran, right? They right. viewed Iran, Syria as a threat primarily. You know, part of it was gas pipelines from Qatar up to Europe. But, you know, the more important thing was it was denying Iran an ally with access to the Mediterranean. And of course, a close proximity to Hezbollah. So if you take out Syria or at least destabilize it, then you weaken Iran. And that was, I think that was always the rationale behind the actions against Syria by the United States. But now, with Syria, at least starting to shift into a frozen conflict phase, at least as regards the U.S. and Turkey and the Syrian government. And we have this move with the U.S. dropping the JCPOA, and it's accompanied at the exact same time by Israel increasing direct attacks in Syria on what it claims are Iranian forces in right. Syria. Right. And it seems clear to me that this is and this has been backed up by the Duma member Slutsky, who is the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Russian Duma. He said outright, this is part of a phased, planned series of provocations following on the heels of the withdrawal of the JCPOA, whose end goal is for Israel and for the neocons in the U.S. to draw the U.S. into a direct conflict with Iran, right? And we knew that was Trump's endgame. We hoped it was a long way off, and that Russia might be able to forestall it. But it seems to be coming at least a little faster. I mean, we're not talking imminent. We're not talking carrier groups moving in the direction or
today.
Anything. But in a number of months, a year. I think we're definitely will be moving in that direction, and Israel has now increased the frequency, the size, and the depth of its airstrikes in Syria, again supposedly targeting mm-hmm. Iranian and previously Hezbollah forces. Mm-hmm. They conducted over a dozen strikes. They claimed, of course, it was defense. There was an Israeli strike. That was what started it. Then Syria responded by firing missiles at Israeli forces in the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights. Israel claimed that this was Iran striking back against them. Iran has military advisors and special forces and militias in Syria, but it doesn't have 20 missile launch units,
right.
that sort of thing. That is clear. So that was of course nonsense. But Israel used that as an excuse to attack a large scale attack across Syria. 60 missiles, 60 air-to-ground missiles, 10 surface-to-surface missiles involving nearly some 30 F-15s and F-16s and at targets all over Syria. This was the largest Israeli attack on Syria in decades.
Yeah, since the 60s, right? Or the early 70s, yeah.
Now, the results of this, the number of deaths seems to have been extremely light.
Right.
There's no Syria and the Russian government say that the Syrian air defense systems alone managed to shoot down over half of these missiles. Mm. Now, Russia did not even turn on its air defense systems to defend Syria once again. Mm. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Moscow the day before the attacks, nominally as a guest of honor of the Victory Day celebrations, celebrating, you know, the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Netanyahu was with Putin for some 10 hours, and we can only presume they had extensive discussions. Primarily, to my mind, on was the delivery of S-300 systems. After the most recent U.S. and some earlier Israeli attacks, we have to remember that Israel has illegally and aggressively attacked Syria over 100 times since 2011. And for the most part, until the most recent months, Syria has never attacked back. They have never taken any type – they've rarely even turned on their air defense systems. And this is because they were hoping, under Russia's tutelage, we can presume, to avoid a direct escalation, avoiding these obvious provocations of a direct war with Israel, which would lead right to a direct war with the United States. They hope to keep concentrating on the ground, on the proxies, which of course Israel and the U.S. and Saudi and Turkey and Qatar and the U.K. and others were backing. They hope to win the ground on the fight on the ground for territory against the proxies, but never engage with the masters of the proxies, as it were, directly, even in the scope of these provocations. Russia seemed to tolerate this because most of the time the Israeli attacks seemed focused on Hezbollah. Never mind, of course, that Hezbollah was one of the most potent forces fighting the jihadis on the ground, and that includes Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But, the number of Israel's own media citing the number of times that both Al-Qaeda and ISIS fighters have been treated in Israeli hospitals shows us clearly that Israel didn't actually have much interest in those jihadis being defeated, and there's plenty of evidence that they were actively they've admitted as much, that they were actively backing at least some of these Islamist rebels in the south.
Right.
There
was a multi-dimensional. Go ahead, because I want to go to this. There was a multi-dimensionality to this that, as we were looking at it, a year ago. Right away when Trump, even when he won the election, even when he was rising in the polls, really, where, Trump is Putin's, puppet, his pet, whatever, Russia, bad guy, that had been cranking up since really 2007, but, major, push since 2014, and then again during the campaign. Trump saying, wouldn't it be nice to be friends with Russia and taking some, spending some considerable political capital on that point. And some of us looking at this saying, no matter what he says about Iran, if he really values, improving relations with Russia, he can't turn around and go to war with Iran under the current configuration of things in Syria, regionally evolving, and then of course, the Road Belt project, which goes through that area, the considerations for China. And so, he has been thwarted, at least publicly, from pursuing improved relations with Russia, and you have all of the things that have happened.
In fact, he's been pushed towards making them considerably worse than they were.
Exactly.
Even from when Obama left office.
Pushed and pulled. Pushed here and pulled there, like with the sanctions bill, for example, that they just passed 500 and whatever, without him.
Congress passed dictating foreign policy over the head of the executive branch.
Including adding sanctions to Iran, by the way, which nobody's bringing up right now, as they parade members of Congress to say how terrible Trump is for walking away from this deal. Well, the only thing in this deal for Iran was a sanctions relief, and those are just 510 or whatever out of 500 535 of those people just voted again to add to the sanctions, you know, obligation on top of them. So
yeah, there's more than a bit of partisan hypocrisy on the Democrat side of all
of this.
It's
like wild, but here we are now with the, you know, you've got like this multidimensional aspect to it, and I'm wondering if there's an impact on, you know, if we're not getting forced into, you know, a confrontation with Iran because it's been decoupled from a improved relationship from Russia, or, you know, however this is all playing out. Like, I wanted you to maybe roll that around a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm part of at least some political figures, Washington and rationale behind the handful that had the idea of improved relations with Russia was turning Russia against both Iran and China. And, you know, I don't know how seriously that was ever considered, because I don't think there's any possibility. Right. I frankly just don't think Russia, the Russian government, at least the current one, isn't that stupid.
Right.
And you know, they've seen the writing on the wall. I think Putin finally learned his lesson in Libya, and that's when he decided to return to office. And of course, that's only continued with Syria and Yemen, and now this focus on Iran. So I don't think there was ever really any hope there. But you know, there's a bit of a sense. Putin, you know, of course, when he first took office, he wanted to improve relations with the rest. You know, he even talked about, Russia joining NATO or of a new security architecture. He did not want to end up as the anti-Western president of Russia in alliance with the, you know, the mullahs and in Iran and with China. Right. That is where events and the U.S. has simply pushed things with its own foreign policy aggressions, regime changes, and, you know, color revolutions, you know, across the former Soviet space. Right. So he's been pushed there. You know, he's maybe not natural bedfellows with the government in Iran, but they have gotten along surprisingly well since then. I think this latest round with Netanyahu in Russia, right after the U.S. Attacks and some of the most recent Israeli attacks, there was an attack that perhaps Israel did not warn Russia about through their deconfliction channels beforehand in Russia. That was the April 9th attacks, and Russia gave a very harshly worded rebuke against Israel for that. They immediately started talking about, well, you know, our policy has been not to supply Syria with the S-300 air defense system, mostly to placate the United States and Israel. And, we figure that you've just abrogated these, you know, deals that, you know, backroom deals that we had with these latest attacks. So we feel free to do that now. And there was some noise in that direction. And I think a big part of Netanyahu's trip to Moscow was to make sure. And sure enough, already within since that trip, some Russian officials have come out and affirmed that there is no deal at present to send the S-300 to Syria, where they were making very strongly worded statements in the opposite direction beforehand. So once again, the delivery of S-300s to an ally is, you know, a bargaining chip. And I find this particularly egregious. Now, Russia has provided, you know, less advanced and more localized air defense systems, such as the Panzer S-1s, to Syria and so on. But they've supplied the S-400 to China. There's deals to deliver it to Iran. And I'm still don't believe this will – I hope to God this never actually happens.
Turkey.
But supposedly there is a deal to deliver it to Turkey, which shot down a Russian jet and has been, you know, the jihadi Disneyland central for shoveling, you know, arming, training, and supplying jihadis into Syria. There is no Russian soldier who has died in Syria that has not died without some of their blood on Erdogan's hands. Yeah. So I find that particularly repulsive. But I still believe that's a bit of bluff towards the U.S. On both of their parts. We'll see how that actually plays out. But the fact that they won't deliver the S-400s to Syria, S-300s, much less the S-400s, the S-300s, that seems to be a bargaining chip. And every indication is that Russia was warned about these latest strikes beforehand, which accounts for the low casualties all around. The highest number of casualties seem to be from Syrian air defense units that targeted the Israelis during the attack, which is I guess the minimum that can be expected. So Russia seems to have cut some deal, but what I'm really worried about is that Israel will attempt to do what Turkey has done in North Syria. Their big complaints are always about, they can't stand an Iranian or Hezbollah presence in Syria, as if Syria doesn't have the right to choose who its allies were, and of course the allies who have helped it to fight off the jihadi proxy war that Israel has of course had their hands in from the beginning. So that there's a bit of complete hypocrisy there. But I'm afraid that when the Syrian government is finishing up in Yarmouk camp, which has been controlled by ISIS, and the next likely target for liberation is in this extreme south of Syria around Daraa. And I'm afraid that Israel may send troops in there to carve out a self-protection zone or a border zone within south Syria, just like Turkey has done in north Syria, supposedly to protect their country from terrorists. And then aside from the rebels, you will have the U.S., Turkey and Israel all basically claiming parts of Syria as their de facto territory. Right. And I'm hoping that whatever deal Russia struck, I don't like, Russia not getting in on this. I mean, Russia did not even turn on their air defense systems. You would think that for an ally that they have a mutual defense pact with, the absolute minimum they could have done is fired their purely defensive air defense system at unmanned incoming missiles. That would seem to be not a very provocative response, but Russia did not even do that. Right. So obviously there's some kind of deal cut with Netanyahu here.
And you said, though, that in terms of casualties, that they were very light.
They were, and it's obvious that Russia warned their allies, and that is a result of that. And Russian-Israeli relations have been improving since 1992, and particularly under Putin. Israel, even last year, recognized Russian Victory Day on May 9th as their national holiday celebrating that day. Right. And a large part of that is simply because there are an extremely large number of Soviet emigres to Israel. That's like a third of the population right now.
Yep.
And they have significant political power, including in backing Netanyahu.
Yep.
And plus the fact that Hamas has turned increasingly towards a hardline Islamist, even Wahhabist bent. Russia still recognizes Palestine as an independent state, but they have a problem finding Palestinian interlocutors that they can deal with, and of course that's part of Israel's plan all along. Right. But Israel and Russia, for a whole host of geopolitical and other reasons, have been managing their relationship and slowly improving relations despite everything that's happening in Syria.
Mm. So. We've got about 3 minutes left here. One of the things I wanted to take a look at, because this always kind of, it sets me thinking anyway. When they talk about, here's some S-300s, oops, never mind. Here's some S-400s, oops, never mind.
Psych!
Yeah,
psych!
Exactly. if you look at the things that are happening in and around Syria and some of these other spots too, by the way, it's hard not to consider the possibility that we're in, you know, World War III or in some run-up to it or, you know, some dress rehearsal or whatever. And, you know, some of these weapons have not been battle-tested. And not just for not just for the Russians' benefit, but for the people who are going to be the targets of these weapons, the NATO and all of that. And, you know, I'm wondering how much of their, you know, reticence in handing these things out and firing them and using them under battle conditions is to try to maintain, you know, that stealth, you know, that secret quality to it so that when they fire them for the first time, it's a surprise to the other side. And
yeah, no, not with air defense systems. No, I see air defense systems are a deterrent. They're a deterrent against air attacks. And in order to have an effective deterrent, the other side has got to know how capable it is. Otherwise, it's not an effective deterrent.
Mm. I mean, if I'm looking to attack...
And Russia is doing a business of selling these systems to other countries.
Right.
And you're right. Russia has tested over 100 new weapons in Syria, much like the U.S. does and the U.K. does in every conflict they've had in the Middle East region. And they've been testing all of these, but the air defense systems. And I believe that is because the sensitivity with Israel and the United States concerning Syria and Iran that, you know, they and to be fair enough, even the older point air defense systems, such as the Panzer S-1, by at least Russian accounts, have proven extremely effective against both U.S. cruise missiles and, you know, Israeli air-to-ground missiles. I mean, they have demonstrated localized systems, but a fully integrated modern high-tech system involving these S-300s or 400s should be much better. But I see a problem with not using it. I think this would be the perfect – I mean, particularly shooting down just missiles, right, rather than aiming at Israeli or U.S. jets, because that, of course, you know, would be a very provocative step. I you know, when they are attacking another country illegally under UN law and so on, particularly one that Russia has a mutual defense pact with, I actually don't have a problem with that either. But when we're talking, you know, just shooting down missiles, I would think that would be the perfect situation to demonstrate its capability. And the fact that they haven't, I think, is purely political, and much of it involves keeping Israel out of this at least as much as possible out of this conflict.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Have you ever known a hero? Well, here you'll meet one. Also, what is the future of the Transatlantic Alliance in the era of Trump and the prehistory of the next war in the Middle East? Crosstalking resistance. I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. And we have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. Gentlemen, we have a special guest on the program today. And I want to talk about this, the level of dissent in the United States and the West in general, and freedom of speech. And here he is. We're joined by Ray McGovern in Washington. He's a former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Ray, thank you for joining us here. I think most of the viewers of this program know that what has happened to you when you were at the congressional hearings to get through Donald Trump's nominee for the head of the CIA. Can you follow up on what's happened to you? What were you charged with, and what happens now?
Well, I was charged with resisting arrest and also disrupting Congress. I will have to appear in court on the 24th, I think it is, of May, and face those charges. So who knows what will happen? Hopefully, the judge will have looked at the videotape and see how ironic it is that I should be charged with resisting arrest when, so to speak, I was not under my own power in being dragged out of there. One thing that people don't realize is that Senator Richard Burr,
yes,
who's hand in glove with the intelligence people that he's supposed to be supervising, he started the meeting by saying, "Now we're in open session now. We're going to executive session, but there will be people who need to make a statement. All I say to them is, do it quickly, do it fast, and then be gone." I said to myself, "Whoa, that's the first time I've heard a chairman invite somebody to make a statement." And so that was part of what I thought would be okay if I made a short statement and then be gone. And it turned out that they made sure that I be gone, not under my own power. So
yeah, but
it was quite
Ray, what was interesting for me watching the video of you being assaulted is that here there was a hearing on a woman that there is ample evidence that she was involved in brutalizing and torturing people. And then at the same time, you were being brutalized. And I don't think it's unfair for me to say, I think you're 78 years old. I watched that video a number of times. I could not see how you could have possibly been a threat to those police officers. And you didn't look like you were resisting, irrespective of the fact you were being forced on the ground. You thought at the time maybe that your arm had been dislocated. And there seemed to be no interest other than a few people videotaping it here, watching brutalization in public. So, you know, it seems to be, brutalization seems to be the themes of the time.
Ray.
Pete.
Go ahead. Mark, go ahead and ask a question.
Yeah, I have to say, Ray, you look pretty good generally for a 70-year-old guy, a 78-year-old guy, a 24-year veteran of as a CIA analyst. But you're looking a little worse for the wear. I see your glasses are still broken. Could you show us your hands, Ray?
those are real doozies.
Well, they did a job on me.
That is a U.S. police state.
Here's my prison. Well, you know, we have to sort of keep our sense of humor. My youngest daughter, when she saw the picture of my glasses, she said, "Dad, how did they make your right ear down so low? How did they bring the ear down so low?" And I said, "Well."
Okay,
it wasn't the ear. It was the glasses.
But
so
Ray,
that meant that.
Yeah. But let's talk about the level of dissent here, because I mean, what you were invited by the chairman of that committee as a member of the public to express an opinion, but you were not allowed to do that. So what does this tell you about the level of dissent and freedom of speech in the U.S.? I mean, these hearings are very important. Gina, Bloody Gina, probably will get through and be placed as head of CIA. So what about dissent?
Remember where you heard it first, Peter. She's not going to be approved.
Okay.
There are enough decent people in the United States are storming to senators. She's not going to be confirmed. So, yeah, it was set up. Those guys were all ready to pounce on me. I took advantage of the fact that one of them moved away from the front so I could get at least a sentence in. But you saw the rest of what happened. So what we have here is a committee that's supposed to be an oversight committee to see what the CIA is doing. But it's Richard Burr, and it's the kind of overlook committee,
yeah.
And they're hand in glove with the intelligence people they're supposed to be overseeing or monitoring.
Demon, do you want to jump in there?
Well, I think that is just awful what happened, but unfortunately it's a part of a trend. I mean, there are hundreds of people, so-called whistleblowers, in the United States on the no-fly list, and a lot of them were subjected to similar treatment. In Europe, Mateusz Piskorski, the Polish citizen, he has been in jail for 2 years without trial, simply for giving interviews to the Russian media, saying things which the Polish mainstream does not accept. In Latvia, Alexander Gaponenko, who was also frequently on RT, an activist for the Russian minority in Latvia, he has been arrested 2 weeks ago, and no Western media Not a single Western media outlet reported about it. I'm pretty sure this story with Ray is not going to be picked up by the mainstream media in the United States.
Dima brings up a really interesting point because, I saw a couple of comments in the mainstream media, very small marginal comments, but alternative media and social media picked up on your story like a vengeance. I mean, it's all over Facebook right now. I made an announcement on Facebook that you'd be on this program. The positive reaction was so overwhelming. It really made me happy that people do know about this story here, and you're not going to learn about it from the mainstream media.
Well, that's the major point here. That's the backstory. Now, I grew up in New York, first 22 years of my life. I went to school there. I went to university there, and I have lots of friends that are still looking at the grass from on top, okay? They're still around. Now, when I go back to college reunions and I say, blah, 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 they say, Ray, where'd you learn that? I say, what do you mean? Oh, well, it's not in the New York Times.
Yeah.
That's how bad it is. Yeah. It's not in the New York Times. And, of course, I didn't expect to be in the New York Times, nor was I, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. So it's really encouraging that this goes viral among people who feel the same way we do for the most part. But it's, I guess the main story, in my view, is that nobody knows why I did what I did. And what I did was quite within my rights. Ron Wyden, the senator, had asked Gina Haspel, were you there in Thailand? Did you supervise the waterboarding of Al Nashiri? And she said, Senator, that's classified.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm out of time. Now, why was it classified? Well, Senator, I classified it. I classified lots of incriminating evidence against me. So let's go into secret session.
She classified. So let's make sure our viewers understand. She classified information about herself.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. There's oversight there.
Not only did she classify it, she destroyed evidence. Right. Which is also a federal crime.
Go ahead, Ray.
Even though Ron Wyden ran out of time, right, so he couldn't follow up. But here's the chair, right? And he knows that every one of those senators know that, sure, she did supervise the waterboarding of Al Nashiri at that black site in Thailand. Everyone knows that, okay? So why didn't he intervene? Why didn't he say, now, Ms. Haspel, we have the documents, of course. So you say they're secret, but it's a little odd that you should be allowed to classify these. So would you answer yes or no? Were you there when he was waterboarded? Of course you would have to say yes. So that's the cover up here. That's the supreme irony, that she can classify and make unavailable to the public, to the people who are supposed to be watching what person this is that's nominated to be the head of the CIA. I mean, this is an open hearing. It's to inform the American people. And she says, no, I'm sorry. That's classified. I can't. That's Senator. That's classified.
Well,
it's really bizarre in this country.
Apparently, gentlemen, her nickname, Bloody Gina, number one, apparently she kind of liked the nickname.
Yes.
And number two, there are reports that she enjoyed that kind of enhanced interrogation. I mean, this is kind of a reflection of a mindset. Okay?
You know, nice nicknames these people have, the defenders of democracy. Mad Dog, Bloody Gina. They are going to defend democracy 100%. Can you imagine someone at the Nuremberg trial, the German Nazis were there accused of torturing people. Can you imagine Goering saying, I can't tell you if I did this. This is classified. They would say that they were fighting communism or they were resisting Jewish onslaught, but they would never say it was classified.
This is as if Nuremberg never happened. I mean, this is what happens to a 24-year veteran of the CIA when he protests against a torturer and war criminal. Let's be clear. Gina Haspel is a war criminal for not wanting a torturer to be the director of the CIA. And it's not the first time we've seen this type of brutality, of course. I mean, we all remember Occupy Wall Street, pepper spray cop, Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, anti-Keystone XL, anti-Dakota pipelines. We've seen this again. But Ray, I'm glad that you are trying to keep a sense of humor. And I've got a couple Twitter quotes for you in that vein. Jeremy Scahill, whom I'm sure you know as well as I do, Gina Haspel is waterboarding the glass ceiling. All right. Because, you know, in America, at least at least women have the equal rights to torture.
Okay, 30 seconds.
Mark. Gina Haspel says she worked very hard and sometimes even slept on the floor of her CIA station. That must have been torture from Danielle Ryan, Irish journalist.
Well, gentlemen, I'm glad we're making light of this, and I'm really glad that Ray is okay. But again, it seems to me this is a sign of the times that we have a person that is obviously committed egregious illegal acts, immoral acts. I found it galling that she even talked about repeatedly the morality of what the CIA does. It's quite remarkable. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, let's change gears here. A fascinating article came out in Spiegel Online titled Time for Europe to Join the Resistance here. Of course, this is a reaction to Donald Trump's decision to move to leave the Iran deal, which is a multilateral treaty that was supervised and signed under the auspices of the United Nations Security Council. So it is not a bilateral agreement as it is portrayed in Western media here. Mark, I thought it was interesting, the title, Time for Europe to Join the Resistance. I would say that's a bit too late, but, you know, they might try. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Europe was a member of the resistance before the resistance, existed, as European leaders, had a problem with Donald Trump during his election campaign. And initially, when he took office, they tried various attempts to butter up to him and to try to
in the most embarrassing way.
In the most embarrassing way, but they obviously are invested in this deal with Iran, and they have good reason to be. U.S. trade with Iran last year was $200 million. The EU trade with Iran was $25 billion, right? So that tells you that there are vested interests there, other than, you know, just preventing a war and conflagration across the Middle East. But, you know, I have problem believing that the EU will stick by their guns. We've seen them, bow down before, even when Obama was wiretapping Angela Merkel's phone.
Yeah, but the reason why this happened, let me go to Ray in Washington. One of the reasons why using the term resistance is all nice and fine, but what power do they have to resist? There's not much there, and this is a result of them abrogating their own security interests, their own borders, I would say, and going along with American postmodernist social theory. I mean, they've just essentially castrated themselves. Now they're angry and upset, but they're defenseless, more or less. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, they have castrated themselves. And the question really is, Peter, it's 73 years since the end of the war. Now, I lived in Germany for 5 years. I know Germans, and I know the younger generation for which there is real hope. But the notion that after the war, the Germans would act like juveniles or adolescents and always bow to the winners of the war. I mean, that's 73 years. When are they going to grow up and act like adults when their own economic and other interests are concerned? I think this may be the time, because never before have we had a certifiable crazy person in charge of Washington. It's quite a pass when the restraining influence has to be exerted by a guy who likes to be called Mad Dog Mattis, okay? So you have a situation here which is new, and if they don't rise to the occasion now, I won't see Europe acting as an independent entity in my lifetime.
Dima, I agree with Ray, but I think it's far too late. I mean,
absolutely.
They would have to, I mean, when you have these globalist elites, they're so integrated. I mean, that is assuming that Merkel, Macron, and May actually have a lot of power. I don't think they do, actually. They're certainly out of touch with their electorates, okay?
Well, they just struck Syria together with Trump, and he wasn't mad. And they were proud about it. You know, Macron said it was a matter of honor for Europe to go along with Trump against Syria. So in order to resist, the main problem is not having the financial power to do it. The main problem is having the moral right to do it. Europe went along with every action against Iran and against many other Middle Eastern countries in the last 30 years. So when Der Spiegel writes that in Trump's Washington, the only thing that matters is dismantling the legacy, peaceful legacy of his predecessor, Barack Obama.
I'm sorry, did you say peaceful?
Well, yes.
What? Huh?
Exactly. Huh? You know, Barack Obama.
Nine countries.
That's Barack Obama said that he has all the options.
Because
on
he's
the
got
table.
A Nobel Peace Prize, right? That's right. Because he was
bombing
peaceful.
Bombing only nine countries is peaceful for exactly. A U.S. president.
Ray, do you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just point out that there was the Iraq War.
Right?
And Gerhard Schröder said no, you know. Now he said no, and then, of course, he let the U.S. use all his bases and everything else in Germany. But he did say no, and so did the French. So there is some hope here. I mean, the situation is really different than ever before. You have people who are not fully in possession of their faculties running our country and running the alliance, so to speak. You have places like Turkey drifting away from NATO. Montenegro, I don't think that really substitutes for Turkey. So this is a time of flux. And if the, you know, sadly, in Germany, you have Aschlöcher in charge of the foreign ministry and von der Leyen, you know, how did Defense Minister von der Leyen get to be Defense Minister? Von der Leyen, she yeah. lies all the time.
But,
von
but
der Leyen about Russia
James
and his
friend,
all
you
the
know,
kind
von der
stuff.
Leyen.
But you know, but Russia. Ray, the, for me is it's not. I agree on the economics thing. I mean, you know, of course, the Europeans would be afraid of being sanctioned by the United States. They're more than willing to give up on their own national interests. We've seen this for 30 years. This is a pattern here. But for me, the dimension of leadership. There's a huge leadership gap. We don't have a de Gaulle, okay? We don't have a Margaret Thatcher. I mean, you know, at least she had a vision. You could agree or disagree with it, but she had a vision. I would even say Helmut Kohl had a vision for Europe. I don't see any of these characters now have a vision for Europe. They've gotten so used to taking orders from Washington, and now we have this situation where we have not just a president, we have Mike Pompeo, we have John Bolton, and we're going to have Bloody Gina. I'm sorry, I'm going to disagree with you. I think she's going to make it. Go, Dima, you want to jump in there?
Well, I just wanted to say that when I read in Der Spiegel, clever resistance is necessary, as sad and absurd as that may sound, resistance against America. End of quote.
Mark,
well, it's not resistance against America, it's resistance against the ideology.
This article is so Euro. It's so Euro. It's weak. It's moaning. It's snowflake nonsense
belated.
Here. It's too late.
It's belated.
First of all, I have a problem with the term resistance. We can't even talk about the U.S. Democrats since they approved a sanctions bill that not only targeted Russia, North Korea, and Syria, mm-hmm. but also targeted Iran while this agreement was still in effect. So, I mean, which would seem to be a breach of it, in to my mind at least, and in many others. I think the EU will just wait Donald Trump out. Their problems with him is mostly partisan and ideological. If this was Hillary Clinton leading the charge in the dissolution of this agreement, she'd be holding their hand and they'd be going along
so
with
So you're
her.
Assuming Trump's is a one-term president.
We'll make that assumption. We'll make that assumption.
Well,
Macron this week, when faced with the possibility that a U.S. may put tariffs and sanctions on European companies if they do business with Iran now. He said, what, are we America's vassal? To which my reply is, we. Yeah, you are. Merkel said, Merkel said we can no longer rely on the U.S. for our defense.
Too late.
Yeah, Angela, I hate to tell you something, honey, but the biggest threat to your sovereignty and security is the U.S.
Okay. Ray, one of the interesting things is that we have the Trump's decision to withdraw from the Iran deal. But what's really quite remarkable is that we hear from the State Department, even though the United States is no longer a member of this multilateral treaty, we expect the Iranians to comply with the treaty. I mean, there's so many different dimensions right there that don't make any sense. Why did the United States leave if they're in compliance? And we don't want to be party to that agreement, but you must, being still in it, you must comply. The rank hypocrisy of all, it's so illogical. Okay, how can countries around the world look at the United States as a reasonable actor now?
Yeah, well, Peter, it's giving hypocrisy a bad name, let's face it, but it's not the first time. I want to introduce a factor here that's of overwhelming significance and which is never mentioned. In his major speech on 1 March, President Putin talked about a growing, very, very substantial alliance, in effect, with a country named China. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I earned my spurs analyzing the Sino-Soviet dispute when they were loggerheads, when they were fighting military clashes against their riverine borders. I know what that was like. In my short lifetime, I've seen a complete change. If there's trouble, if China supports Russian policy in Syria and in Ukraine. If there's trouble in either of those places, mark my words, you're going to have trouble in the South China Sea, in the Taiwan Straits. That's how close the military alliance is. Witness the fact that the Chinese newly appointed defense minister, the first thing he did was travel to Moscow. They asked him why. He said, because I want to express my solidarity what the Russians are doing in this era of challenge. So that's a new element. And that is something that I've been trying to get into the press about now, because I don't think Mad Dog Mattis, I don't think Trump, I don't think Bolton, they don't know that. They're proceeding from the old paradigm where after the war in 91 in Iraq, the main lesson was we can do these things and the Russians won't stop us. Yeah, well, the Russians are not alone now. The Russians and the Chinese can stop us.
Yes, but another historical analogy, Ray, considering what you just said about China vis-a-vis Ukraine and Syria, August 1914, okay, the possibility of these interconnecting alliance systems getting out of control and escalation. Go ahead, Mark.
China's got its own interests. I mean, after Russia, Iran is the biggest supplier of energy to the Chinese industrial, economic machine. So they've got their own interests with Iran.
30 seconds, Dima.
You know, when people say that economy is so important, China is following its economic logic, which Mark has described just very well here. Europe, despite the fact that they trade with Iran to the tune of $25 billion a year, just look how easily they destroyed their relationship with Russia. It cost them a lot more. It cost them at least $100 billion.
Twice as much as it cost Russia.
Four times more than with Iran. And they still went ahead with it, despite the fact that Russia was no threat. No threat at all.
Can you spell castration? Okay, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.